So thanks again to Bob and White Whale and to all you coming out and to being part of this great group of poets today. So this is a poem called Prodigal Son Returns to Warren, Michigan. And I'm just going to pull this back up a little bit. I haven't read this before, but we'll see how it goes. It's a prose poem. So I was born in Detroit, and then we moved to Warren, right on the edge of 8 Mile Road, which Eminem made famous, the border there. Prodigal son returns to Warren. The air stings, but you get used to it. We're always used to it. Buried in your lungs at birth in anticipation of today. Dark comfort, burning oil, leaking transmission fluid, exploding antifreeze. A lot can go wrong and already has. That's the darkness. The comfort's buried behind the garage. Cigarette smoke, trying to quit. Lifetime hobby, like collecting LSD stamps. Marking stale beer kisses on your warped globe. Thumbnail bruise slowly making its way to the top. To be released. Good luck with that bruise on your heart. Life in Warren, backfire, misfire, deliberate fire, shotgun arson, that hiss leaking out that globe or a spray can sending another inscrutable message. Night breaks glass, day keeps peace, peace on loan from the bank, interest on a ticking clock, the bank a robot hooker, hydrant full of trick questions and fake water, air stings, you sting it back. The invitation lost in the mail with the lost children. Welcome home, soldier. Have we got a minimum wage job for you? No burned bridges. Our bridge takes you to Canada. That girl you always liked that was too nice for you. Ribbons and curls and a mean big brother. Forgot to wipe your shoes on the way out of town. You follow the smudged footprints back. What were you thinking, leaving? Like the senile dog barking at the wrong door to get back in. It happens. Night is different here, spiked with acrid fear. Fists just lumps in your pockets. Nobody's built a hill yet. Uphill and downhill, relative terms. Related by marriage. Separated by birth. Blinded by the lack of light. The absence of an acoustic guitar. The dance of electric shock. One word for gray, hundreds of shades of it. Comfort, one word for it. Rungs on the ladder, imaginary. Leak in the roof, real. Basement nightmare, flooded. Cocaine cut on a ping pong table, behind the eight ball, behind a cue stick hammering down. It's all coming back. Blood on an empty dress burned down the neighborhood, but it's still here. Just needs a jump. Got cables? Gentlemen, start your engines. The air stings with old spit and large betrayal. Rust mobiles rattling and mumbling their damned prayers. Transportation specials. Dark comfort, dome light glow. Somebody getting in, getting out. Idling. Flashers on, adjusting mirrors, emergency, waiting for someone, maybe you. Thanks. Rowing Inland came out in the spring, and I'm going to read the title poem from this. I think a lot of my poems are about rowing inland, just like that other one, back to Detroit. Rowing Inland. On the only vacation of my childhood, we followed the Detroit legend of Great Lakes, Great Times, up the gridlock of I-75 to a cottage in the holy expanse we called Up North. On Tea Lake, where I never saw anyone drink tea or discuss tea or remark that the color of the lake resembled tea, we rented one of the dilapidated shacks owned by a cousin of our neighbor Bronco and referred to without irony as a resort. I was rib-bone skinny at 10, and Kim, Bronco's daughter, was 9, blonde hair bleached by that bright young sun. Our parents drank beer and smoked cigarettes, as always, but longer, with more savor, and splintery chairs on that splintery dock. Our fathers discussed fishing, but did no fishing. They shouted to those in rowboats, "How's the fishing?" But they did no fishing. I only faintly began to realize life was mostly a series of rhetorical questions. Hot enough for you? Working hard or hardly working? Our fathers carried identical black lunch buckets each morning to different locations linked by the same underground tunnel of machinery and grease and one giant time clock registering the equation of the city's heartbeat divided by the number of new cars built that year. Our mothers discussed other mothers and swore off cooking for a week, swore like they never did at home. Shit, they sighed, shit, echoing out over calm water. Straps on bathing suits hung loose. They painted their nails because they could. They lost track of their children. Kim and I sat in a rotting wooden rowboat on the weedy shore. We donned faded orange life vests and placed oars and locks and rowed through sand and air calling stroke, stroke, like we'd seen in a cartoon about a dog. We never laughed at cartoons. No one ever really got hurt. No TV at TV like at Tea Lake. Coffee and beer. We were allowed orange drink and paper cartons and potato chips galore. Left alone, we caught fireflies and poison ivy, mosquito bites and berries, and firecrackers from the bad kid down the road who spat with alarming accuracy. We waded in shallow water, screwing our feet in a cold muck. Roads were dirt and street signs non-existent. We carved our names on white birch bark and imagined we had the bravery and stealth of Indians. After a week, we were back on the grid of our shallow street, riding the banks of curbs on our bikes and setting ants on fire. If you look at anything long and hard enough, it catches fire. Another giant clock out there, the tragedy clock. No second, minute, or hour hands, just a big gong sounding without warning. One stroke after another killed her father. He called me Jimmy, limping out of his pickup, bearing that black metal coffin home each day while I sat on her porch or mine. Kim and I kissed in the realm of first and foremost, climbing out bedroom windows when we were 13. But we never went to the church of full penetration and instead slipped away from each other like embarrassed fish released back to water, still bloody from the hook. I didn't get anyone pregnant until I was 23. We had to gas up twice and cross state lines for the procedure. Kim left school and married the father. It didn't sit right with Bronco. She moved away and I didn't see her for years. Bronco held her child in his wheelchair the last time I saw either of them. I waved from my porch. "It's Jimmy," I said. Her husband, "Do you want me to go on pounding the tragedy clock with my mallet?" Stroke, stroke, we rode together over the shore. And so street calligraphy is no longer forthcoming. It's fourth and it's here. So I'm going to read a couple poems from this to try it out. This is called Tennis Practice Wall. You know, sometimes they just build this big wall and you're supposed to hit tennis balls against it, and it often gets used for various other things, particularly in Warren, where no one played tennis. Tennis practice wall. Brick painted dull yellow once, then abandoned to spray artists and drunken fools acting out their own drive-in movies. Variations on the theme of I was here, but someone else was here too, and someone else. Some dude even smashed his car into the tennis practice wall to test his own theory. Why didn't it collapse on top of him? If the taped black horizon line symbolizing net, rules, scorekeeping morphed into a penis or snake or knife or all three, if the words are illegible, encoded or profane, and they are all that, what fraction of sincerity can get you a six-pack or even just a 40-ounce at the party store across the street? A practice wall for pissing, though no one needed practice. Its shaded, raised, and crumbled fault lines of blacktop judged sufficient by men who had not and never will. Hit the ball, stupid. Imaginary wall of future nightmare smudged with factory dust. Graffiti scrawled as high as a hand, raised in a classroom by a boy who never raised that hand. This is his answer. I am here and not here. Build it and they will come, theory. But no one ever came to hit a ball, only to have to hit it again. We are raised on the farther you hit it theory, as explained to us in textbooks we did not read or carry home. So if I did hit a tennis ball here once, and I'm not saying I did, I hit it over the damn wall and it rolled across the parking lot towards the school's auto shop, which had its own perfectly good windowless wall if someone so desired to, desire. On a scale of 1 to 10, I smashed the motherfucking scale with a sledgehammer, given my aversion to the subtlety of accuracy. I, who tested another theory at the tennis practice wall one night with a girl I loved, we stood unbuckled and leaned into it until it disappeared. And two more. This is a Detroit story. It might be embellished a little bit, but it's the story of what happened to my grandfather's house. It's called Grandfather Rents to Pimp. We were escaping him from Detroit to a smaller, crappier house in Warren next to his sister Martha and her maiden daughter Irene with a mangled hand who worked for Quaker Oats, highlighting her life with free boxes of Cap'n Crunch. We borrowed Mr. Carson's van before he himself escaped to Arizona, a retired postal worker tired of dodging wild dogs and delivering mail to burn out, abandoned, or simply empty lots of the city. The absurd anti-logic of it. Bags full of mail to Santa Claus on the moon. No forwarding address. Not even junk mail to mark as their territory, like the dogs casually chewing the bones of other postmen. We humored Grandpa in the house. No one paid cash money for swampland in the hood. Crackheads, the only interested observers, and even then it was a buyer's market. But he found Reverend St. Pierre, who wanted to rent rooms to hookers he was rehabbing, taking them off the street, he said. Grandpa wouldn't know a hooker if one bit him on the ass like one of those wild dogs, much less that he'd have to pay extra for that. So Rev gives Grandpa a month's rent, and Grandpa thinks he's going to be shitting gold bricks the rest of his life. But you know from the title that Reverend St. Pierre is preaching a different gospel, and when Grandpa keeps going back to pick up things we deliberately abandon, particularly his collection of plastic milk cartons, he notices the Rev don't got no collar, no vestments, not even a damn cross on a thick gold chain round his neck. And then, of course, there ain't no second month's rent, and my father's not paying water or electricity anyway, writing letters to the city conceding everything. Take my house, please. And Grandpa loses his license for driving too slow on those streets, where nobody should be stopping unless they got an appointment with the Rev or a standing order at Crack House Number 3. So Grandpa watches TV in the tinier house that boots Grandma out into madness at the earliest opportunity. Suddenly, she can't find the bathroom because the only bathroom she's ever known is full of hookers across town, and tells us the Rev's ladies wore jock straps and he didn't know what sport they played. Oh, Grandpa, what are we going to do with you? We waved the white flag on our way out of town while I spilled scalding coffee on my lap to stay alive behind the wheel of that van spewing black exhaust. Mr. C gave me all his thick socks and insulated postal gloves because he was going someplace warm and dry where they'd imported the London Bridge, though they had no water in Arizona except a drinking fountain at the Sunoco station. Back in Detroit, Grandpa spent that 1 month's rent on a new drill and a lifetime supply of racial epithets, the arteries of his beloved city hardening, and damn it, you gotta blame somebody. And the Reverend didn't last a year without utilities. The crackheads still might be there. Like roaches, they can survive nuclear shenanigans. And being a white guy born in that city, I have only the cynical patter of the sideline reporter. But when I think of hookers turning tricks in those rooms, those beds of my childhood, I regret leaving behind Grandma's music box, the tiny dancer alone, waiting for the fire. And this is a poem about parenthood called Model / Father, and uses as its kind of metaphor building those little models when I was a kid. The monster ones were my favorites. I had a great model, Henry Ford, that I built. Model Father. I separated the plastic pieces from their factory pressings and carefully laid them out on the newspaper, though I had not yet read it. I unfolded the thin instructions and squinted and held them at a distance. I blinked, tab A into slot B. I stuck a safety pin in the glue to release it. I no longer needed a note from my father to buy glue. I didn't sniff the glue. Not too much. Not much at all, really. I woke up 18 years later. My son had a beard, which he stroked semi-wisely, and my daughter had breasts and a smirk I did not recall. I compared my model to the one on the box. Don't try this at home, or on the road, or anywhere. I was missing a tiny piece, the brain, I think. Directions are overrated. The father did not fit in the bottle. The father emptied the bottle. The father marked the bottle XXX. The father painted the model, but his paintbrush was not tiny enough for all the tiny parts. The model was a mess, its mouth a slurred whisper, its belly thick with layered paint. Its hair fell out due to a mysterious lack of glue. We took it outside in the ice and snow. My son brought the matches, my daughter the explosives. Thank you.